2000, Matthew Neal published English Passengers, also set in the 19th century, but this time turning away from London and focusing on the horror of what the British did to the Aboriginals in Tasmania. In an interview, Matthew Neal said, "I had written about Victorians being disastrously wrong-headed at home in London, and so it seemed only right to look at them being disastrously wrong-headed overseas." So your conference today, Matthew Neal, will precisely focus on what brings a British novelist to write about the wickedness of the British Empire.
Thank you, Vanessa and Francois, and also thank you very much to Catherine Peso-Miguel for a very insightful and excellent talk, which I hope I don't repeat some of the things you've already looked at too much. Anyway, what brings a British novelist to write about the wickedness of the British Empire? First, and quite selfishly, I needed a subject. Novelists may like to think of themselves as storytelling philosophers, enlightening the world, but at times they're more like vultures, scouring for anything that may give them a book. One might think that this should be easy, seeing as a novelist has limitless freedom of choice, but surprisingly, few ideas are exactly right. You need something that is intriguing to the writer, yet also has the potential to intrigue thousands of strangers. Something that is large and complex enough to fill a novel's canvas. And something that feels new, either because it's not much known about, or because you've seen a way of portraying it in a new way. My previous novel, Sweet Thames, was set in London in the 1840s and attempted to examine that strange phenomenon, the Victorian British mind. Why not, it finally occurred to me after a good deal of vulture-like searching, write something about the English overseas in their empire. It could be very telling to see how my compatriots had behaved in collision with faraway cultures. Taken by the idea, if not yet sure, I went to a bookshop to discover a little more. I was living in Oxford at this time, which has one of the largest bookshops in the country, Blackwell's, with a huge history section, and I began scouring the shelves. To my surprise, I found almost nothing at all. On this vast subject that encompassed several centuries and numerous parts of the world, all I found was a single, rather old, three-volume account. The more I thought about this, the more strange it seemed. After all, the empire had only come to an end a generation or two ago, and there were still a few wind-blown bits of it left even now. When my parents were young, it had been a large part of the country's identity, and its legacy was everywhere you cared to look, in statues of generals with lists of unpronounceable victories on the plinths, in old railway stations with Indian architecture, in people who had emigrated from these faraway places, brightening up a grey land and its grey food. So why was almost nothing being written about the empire? I could guess the reason. Nobody wanted to know. I sensed that deep down, many English regretted the empire had gone, leaving Britain so reduced in status in the world. At the same time, in a quite contradictory response, many felt embarrassed that the empire had ever existed. It's awkward, after all, for a country that prides itself on being a land of freedom, fairness, and humanity, to realize that not very long ago, it forcibly invaded and occupied a third of the Earth's population with little of thought for their freedom or anything else. Suddenly, this subject seemed rather promising. Perhaps it was my imagination, but as I went round Oxford and other places, noticing the often sour faces, the aura of resentful resignation, I began to feel that this was a country haunted by the ghost of its dead empire. I began to feel that this was something that should be written about, if only to help the British get a more profound sense of who they are, good and bad. Was this unpatriotic? I didn't mind if it was. There are many aspects of England that I feel very affectionate towards, but I feel it's one of the most important aims of a writer to question widely held beliefs, including national myths. So, the empire it will be. There was no point in being half-hearted, so I might as well go for the very worst of the story. I remembered a television documentary that I had seen as a child and which had somehow stayed in the memory for all that time, and which described the colonization of the island of Tasmania, Australia. Though Tasmania is a good-sized island, as large as Ireland, the British, in just a few decades, destroyed the entire Aboriginal population through a mixture of murderous land greed, colonial incompetence, war, and good intentions gone bad. It was Britain's one true genocide. What's more, as if this were not already enough, the invaders then added insult to injury. When the Aboriginals had been reduced to only a few dozen, a profitable market grew up for their bones, which were keenly sought after by museums in Britain and elsewhere, to be stored in their vaults like trophies. Competitions between bone collectors was fierce, with rivals racing one another to dig up Aboriginal corpses that were barely cold in the ground. I began proper research. Bookshops might be of little use, but fortunately I had access to Oxford's Bodleian Library, which has a very full collection on Australian history. I read for some months, then flew to Tasmania to read more and to get a sense of the landscape by walking in the mountains. The more I discovered, the more I was shocked by what my countrymen's ancestors had done. I don't want to bore you now with Tasmanian history, but I'd like to mention one small story that I came across and which never found its way into my novel. This was of a very ordinary man who features in few historical accounts. He grew up in a small English market town where he led the blameless life of a good citizen. He was not very rich, and like many at that time, was tempted by the offer of free farming land in one of the new Australian colonies, never worrying that the land might already be home to somebody else. He sailed to Tasmania, staying a few weeks in the capital, Hobart, to claim his free land and to acclimatize to the local ways. He clearly acclimatized very well. He kept a diary of his journey riding across Tasmania to his new property, a diary that has survived. It's a cheerful sort of account, as he describes the strange and beautiful place he finds himself in, with its wombats and wallabies and gum trees. He also mentions, in passing, how on several occasions he sees an Aboriginal in the distance. Naturally, he unhitches his rifle and shoots. He's very proud of his marksmanship. Even now, this story haunts me. It seems to echo out in warning across the years. There was more. As I mentioned, there were two sides to the Tasmanian coin, and alongside the genocide, there was also the story of collectors making off with Aboriginal bones. Examining the reason behind this ugly fashion, I found myself again surprised. I discovered that in Europe in the 1850s, a revolution of ideas took place, one that is little remembered these days, though we've been suffering from its consequences ever since. This was the birth of modern racism. There are various possibilities as to what may have brought this about. The outburst of nationalism of the 1848 revolutions, weakening faith in the Bible and its claim that all men are equal, new and accurate guns that gave Europeans a dangerous sense of their own superiority. What I had not realized was that a seedbed of this ugly transformation was none other than easygoing England. In 1850, a disgraced surgeon named Robert Knox published a book entitled The Races of Men, a Fragment. It was, in many ways, a precursor to Hitler's Mein Kampf, if without Hitler's phosphorescent hatred. Knox saw all history as a process of racial conflict, claiming that humankind is actually made up of different species of men, a scientifically ludicrous idea. His book was an immediate bestseller and remained influential for decades. Skulls were collected in a pseudo-scientific attempt to classify the races of men. And, in a final nasty twist, the Tasmanian genocide was widely seen not as something criminal and shameful, but as proof that the island's Aboriginals must have been the very lowest species of man. I had my subject. What was less clear was how on earth this might be made into a story. Any novel requires balance, And this one clearly needed something to cheer people up between pages of racism and genocide. This, I decided, would be a shipload of characters from the Isle of Man, a small Celtic island in the Irish Sea where my father comes from. I'd grown up with stories about the place, and it seemed rich with comic possibilities. The island is small, only 50 kilometers long, and yet in Victorian times, the Manx proudly considered themselves as much a nation as anybody else, with their own Celtic language and ancient parliament. At this time, the Manx were a little like a kind of cold water Sicilians, being accomplished smugglers of brandy and tobacco, and fighting their larger neighbors, particularly the English, not with weapons, but with smiles and seeming helpfulness. In its own small way, the Isle of Man was another unwilling part of the British Empire, while, for all their faults, the Manx were generally a humane lot, not given to big, cruel ideas. A few Manx characters would offer a useful perspective on the book's main subject. I began to see possible lines of a plot. One strand would follow a nasty racist, a fictional Robert Knox, who wants to visit Tasmania to collect Aboriginal skulls, and who, unwittingly, ends up chartering an ill-fated Manx smuggling ship to take him there. A second strand would feature an Aboriginal character and would recount the terrible events on Tasmania. Finally, the two strands would collide. I wanted to write the novel as a series of separate first-person narratives, as this would allow me to try and use different varieties of English, from Manx dialect to Aboriginal style to formal educated English, which would help reflect the complexity of the empire. Different voices would also, I hoped, make the book easier for readers to swallow. Genocide is an unavoidably terrible subject, so much so that it risks putting people off. Novels must entertain, after all, and I had no wish to write a book so full of virtuous intent that nobody would want to read a page. By including various different voices, good and evil, shrewd and blind, each telling their own story in their own way, partial way, I hope to give readers a sense of choice, of making up their own minds as to whom they believed, rather than feeling lectured. So, everything was set. I had my research, characters, and a rough plan. But then, when I tried to begin the book, something unexpected happened. I found I couldn't write it. For weeks I struggled, trying opening after opening, without ever getting beyond page 5. Finally, I realized what was wrong. Any novel needs a sense of surprise, and this, sadly, had none at all. The racist would be bad. The Manx would be humorously humane. The Aboriginals would be resilient, brave victims. So what? It all seemed very predictable. I went for long walks around Oxford, week after week, reshaping characters and chapters in slightly different ways, but liked them no better than before. Eventually, I became so fed up that I tried to abandon the novel altogether and think of something else instead, only to find that the subject was too intriguing to let go. I found myself trapped with a book that would not let me write it, and yet would not leave me in peace. A year passed, a bad year that I would not wish on anybody. Then, just when I was reaching complete despair, salvation came from the radio. One day I happened to hear two programs, one after the other, that gave me an answer. The first mentioned a curious Christian group that I had never come across before, called the British Israelites. This came into existence around 1870 as a kind of splinter group from the Church of England, and its main purpose was to resolve a dilemma that was troubling many thoughtful Victorians at this time. The English knew, without so much as a doubt, you see, that they were the most important nation on earth. They were also very good Christians, who generally led sober lives and read the Bible on Sundays, leading them to assume that they must be God's very favorite souls. And yet, strangely, there was not a single mention of the British in the Bible's many pages. How could this be so? It made no sense. Fortunately, the British Israelites had the answer. There are various references in the Bible to the 12 lost tribes of Israel. Evidently, these must have been more lost than anyone had supposed and had found their way across Asia Minor and the Dardanelles, over the Alps, and finally across the Channel to that green and happy land of England. For close to 100 years, members of the British Israelite sect assembled in dusty rooms to scour the vaguer sections of the Bible for proof of their thesis. The second radio program was about a Victorian expedition to Africa. This had two leading members, both towering egos of their time, who profoundly disagreed with one another on many key questions of the day, both political and religious. The expedition was not a success, and one day in the wilderness, surrounded by stores and bored porters, the two great men came to blows and very nearly killed one another. And what was the cause of their squabble? Some high political or religious question of the day? No, it was about a pillow. All at once, I knew exactly how to write this book. At its core would be a religious scientific expedition to Tasmania. The British Israelites came too late in the Victorian period for my story, but there was ample other madness earlier on, and I discovered that in the 1850s, there was a great deal of interest in locating important biblical sites. The novel's expedition could be seeking to find the Garden of Eden in Tasmania. This misguided enterprise was exactly what I needed, for the very reason that it had nothing to do with the real subject of the book. It was something surprising, around which more serious material could be woven without seeming too obvious. And it offered the chance of a new comic character, himself a reflection on the strangeness of the British way of organizing an empire. This would be the expedition's leader, an infuriating ninny of a Church of England vicar, full of his own blind self-belief, who would become an enemy of the racist, not because of their opposed beliefs, but in the way people actually fall out, over small, stupid annoyances like Richard Burton's pillow. So, I set to work. It had been three frustrating years since I began looking at the subject, and for weeks I woke up each morning amazed that, finally, I was actually writing this novel. But it wasn't all easy. I was particularly concerned as to how I should write the Tasmanian Aboriginal character, Pive. Tasmania's original inhabitants spoke more than nine languages, mostly mutually incomprehensible, and when they were imprisoned by the British on offshore islands, they developed a new language so they could understand one another, a dialect of English with many Aboriginal words. Sadly, this was never recorded. All that has survived is one short and inadequate dictionary of three Tasmanian Aboriginal languages, which offers very few clues as to how Pive might have spoken. I began to wonder if I had any right to invent the speech and thinking of a vanished people, or if I was undertaking a kind of last cultural theft. But then what is fiction, if not an attempt to enter the minds of people whose lives are entirely different from your own? If writers become too sensitive about stepping beyond their own experience, we'd have no novelists, only autobiographers. Besides, it was not as if I was trying to write a definitive account of Aboriginal life. My main target was the British, and the novel would be indefensibly incomplete if it left out an Aboriginal view of what the British were doing to their world. What's more, I didn't feel that Pive's life was entirely beyond imagining. I've always been a very keen traveller, and I once reached the highlands of New Guinea, a remote area where people remained isolated from the rest of the world until the 1930s, encapsulated in a kind of Stone Age bubble. Walking from village to village, I was surprised, but not how unknowable this society was, but rather by how familiar it seemed. Human beings are a fairly recent phenomenon, after all, and for all our cultural complexity, our preoccupations are often much the same wherever you look. To feed oneself, to live in reasonable comfort, to raise children, and to comprehend the confusing world in which we find ourselves. Encouraged by this thought, I tried to piece together the sort of words that might be in Pive's speech. His childhood, spent by the sea and in the forest of the rainy west of Tasmania, would have filled his head with similes and metaphors of nature. To this will be added some Christian phrases from his devout white teachers. Soldiers guarding his people would contribute some coarse slang. Finally, reflecting the era's taste, there might be a little Victorian wordiness and sentimentality. I threw the mixture together and stirred, revising and retrying phrases until they finally seemed plausible. Mostly, I found it very helpful to write using different voices. My previous novels had all featured one continuous narrative, and sometimes, following the same character from place to place, it was hard to maintain variety. With numerous narratives, it was easy. As soon as one speaker had done his work, I simply made them shut up and let somebody else begin. I found I liked using different kinds of speech, from slow, cynical Manx to formalized colonial English to convict slang to Pivet's strange cultural mishmash. Different voices also offered a chance to contrast perceptions, rather like in a theatre farce. And it was fun letting different characters complain about one another, or having them describe the same event, though only one sees what actually is going on. Different voices also helped me control the book's emotional heat. As I mentioned, I was very concerned not to write a moralizing sermon that nobody would want to read. I'm also a strong believer that fiction is more powerful if less is said. Pack an emotive scene with heartfelt language, and you risk leaving your readers with nothing to feel, as the work has all been done for them. Leave out the emotion, and readers may be drawn deep into the vacuum you have left, feeling everything that you have neglected to state. With this in mind, I found it was often useful to have key moments narrated by entirely the wrong character, who doesn't understand or doesn't care. As one example, a scene in the novel describes the final fatal humiliation of the Tasmanian Aboriginals. Imprisoned on an unhealthy offshore island where they're slowly dying, the Aboriginals find themselves subjected to the improving instincts of their pompous English commandant, who's determined to save their souls before they vanish and force them to become model God-fearing subjects. My first thought was to have this angrily recounted by the Aboriginal character, Pivet, but somehow this seemed too flat, as the event and the narrator would be too closely aligned. Instead, I told it through the eyes of a bored and frustrated storekeeper's wife, who doesn't give a damn about the Aboriginals, though she pays them a little sentimental lip service, being much more concerned with how she may win the heart of the pompous and already married commandant who she worships. Lovingly, she recounts his brilliant achievements, though these are, to us, monstrous. So the pages grew, and as they did, I found something very strange began to happen. As I described, with all the coolness I could muster, this world of arrogance, cruelty, and misguided beliefs, I found I began thinking of myself not as English, but as Manx. There was really no justification for this, as though my father comes from the Isle of Man, I was born in London and had only visited the island 3 times in my life. Now, though, walking through the streets of Oxford, buying food in a supermarket or waiting for a bus, I began to see the English all around me as foreigners. I viewed them as the Manx had, as coldly arrogant. Perhaps I was going through some kind of curious cultural therapy. It was as if I needed to put some distance between myself and the country in which I'd been brought up, so I could fully see the evils it had been capable of. Finally, the book was finished and published with the title English Passengers, to make it quite clear who it was about. I was quite curious to know how it would be received, of course, but I didn't worry that angry patriotic mobs might come banging at my door. Why? Because there is still a touch of the British Israelites in the English even today. Deep down, they possess an awesome cultural self-confidence, as if, despite mounting evidence, they know that they are still the most important nation on earth. This leaves them very hard to insult, and they even quite enjoy hearing how dreadful they are, so long as they're still the focus of lots of attention. Sure enough, the novel was received encouragingly by the British book world, with no angry jingoistic charades, though some responses were surprising. My first letter from a reader concluded, "How shocking those times were. I had no idea the Australians got up to such terrible things." so much of my hopes of helping the English face up to their past. But then something unexpected happened. One day I went back to Oxford's bookshop, Blackwell's, and climbed the stairs to the history department. And looking on those same shelves that 7 years ago had had hardly a single book about the empire, I was surprised to find that there were now volumes by the dozen, looking at Africa, India, Australia, and elsewhere, most of them very critical in their appraisal of the British record. So I had not been alone. Without realizing it, I had been part of a small movement. It seemed that a change was underway after all, and that perhaps Britain was finally coming to terms with its past. I just thought actually I might do one very short reading just to really illustrate all the things that I was talking about there, otherwise, so it won't seem too abstract. So it's page 103 in all the editions, and it's from the point of view of the Pivet character, and it's as he's walking with his tribe. He's at war with the British settlers in a tribe led by his mother, who's an admiral but rather frightening character. And they're walking through, and what they're actually about to see is a proclamation nailed to a gum tree by the British saying that all the Aboriginal people have to move to a remote and inhospitable part of the island so that they won't really get in the way of the settlement anymore.
I actually had two questions. The first one was, what was the reception in Australia?
The reception in Australia, it was a mixed reception. I thought it would be mixed, but it was mixed in a way I never expected. It got mostly very good reviews, and it was actually shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Prize, which is not usual for an English writer. It was only possible because its subject is Australian subject. But unfortunately, there was some key figure in Penguin Australia who didn't like the book, so it wasn't a big seller. It just was not really put in the bookshops, and it virtually died there. But I expected it to be given a harder time with reviewers. And in fact, they treated it very generously. So.
And my second question was, were you influenced at all by Majuru's, Dr. Wurudi's prescription, I think, for the ending of the world?
What's that?
Majuru's novel, his exact title I've forgotten, which is Dr. Wurudi's prescribing
yes.
for the end of the world.
And I read that. I found that very interesting. Yes.
And I've just wondered about the way he creates the Aboriginal voice and the way you create it, if you thought of how he was writing at all when you were writing.
Yes. Well, I found it very interesting. This is a novel written by an Australian entirely from the point of view of a Tasmanian Aboriginal. I mean, I found it very interesting. I also felt we were looking at similar themes from completely different angles with a different purpose as well, because I wasn't really trying to write a definitive account of the Aboriginal side. I just felt it was very important that it be included, whereas Moretti's was really much more involved with that whole side of things. So I felt I didn't want to get just tread on the same space too much, as little as I could, but I had to some extent.
To follow up on your question, I know that Susan Barrett is interested in Peter Carey's Kelly Gang, and we know that you wrote a favorable review in the Daily Telegraph. Did Peter Carey mention your novel? Do you know what he thought about it?
I don't know if he ever read it, even.
No,
so I don't
no,
know.
No, no, no.
No,
you could have asked him to write a review.
but his came afterwards, so it was all done.
That's right. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
no,
okay.
No.
No. Fine.
We have talked already about the epilogue and the preface. What do you think about your own preface and epilogue? Why did you write them? I suppose to tell us about the reality behind the fiction. But then I find it slightly double-edged because you cite so many things that you've read that one wonders what the fiction is. For example, my favorite passage in the novel is Potter's mesmerizing of the pig.
Right.
Hilarious. Did you read that in a diary? Or
oh, no.
Your
I mean,
own talent?
I made it all up. I mean, I made everything up, except that I felt, I mean, as somebody who studied history and I love history, I feel it's wrong to write anything that couldn't have happened. So I'd like to do exhaustive research. And in this case, I mean, Robert Knox led a completely different life from Dr. Potter. He was born much earlier, and he never went anywhere. So I wasn't really following Robert Knox's life. I was just using his nasty ideas and the fact that he was a surgeon, and then taking it from there, really. So no, it's all completely fictional.
I'd have a question on Pivet's relation to language, actually. It reminded me to some extent, only to some extent, of Caliban's relation to language in The Tempest, and the way in which both he, his land, his language are colonized. Mm-hmm. And you remember that quote from The Tempest, "You taught me language, and my profit on it is I know how to curse." Mm-hmm. So would you say that for Pivet, the English language is both an imposition but also a weapon,
yes,
a force for him?
I think that's a very good description. I mean, I think it's very. This is, I think, one of the problems for people who've undergone something similar to the experience that Pivet has gone through in many cultures, which is that you are given a choice of opposing a culture, which you may. Which you might be able to use against the people who are imposing it on you. And this leads often to a very confusing and complicated response, I think.
But at the same time, it's also a weapon. He manages to make this language his own, which is a mixed language,
yes,
actually.
Yes, as he needs to. But yes, but he has a complete... I was interested in, or I wanted to offer two different approaches. Pivet's approach is to try and use the culture of the British against them. His mother's approach is just to kill them. And I felt that both were valid in their way, and you couldn't really say that, you couldn't really say which one will succeed. In the end, they both fail to a large extent.
When listening to you reading Pivet's talk, it's so obvious that it's an oral language that you, of course, put through when you read it aloud. I was wondering, did you test some of Pivet's speeches, for instance, with your wife or with other people when you had finished orally?
No. I just wrote it all out and hoped it would be all right, but... I think it makes it a much nicer book to read out than anything else I've done, because it is orally spoken. And on the subject that you brought up about whether these were actually documents or not, when I first began trying to write the book, I actually was going to think of having some place on the Isle of Man where these documents would be found. And I gave up on that when I realized that it would be a limitation on what I wanted to let people say. And in the end, I imagined it more as if they were just speaking somewhere, or all writing, depending on how they would communicate their experiences. But I couldn't limit myself to only having written documents, especially some of the characters wouldn't be able to write.
Now, would you say that being an Englishman living in Rome with a Canadian wife and a father coming from the Isle of Man perhaps induced you into trying to work out what a new language would be, and somewhere you wrote that language was extremely important because it was not only a way of talking but also a way of thinking. So I agree with that. So
yes.
What do you say of your own situation, of course, being faced with people speaking one language and yourself speaking another language, most probably with your wife?
Yes.
And being British?
I would say it's the other way around, that my interest in language, which made me do all of this, also made me live in Rome, and probably also may have helped also with the Canadian wife and the idea of living in Rome so our children could speak other languages. And it's, yes, I think there's definitely a connection.
And at home with your father, did your father use Manx at all?
No, because the Manx language really wasn't much used beyond the early 20th century, so he didn't know it. He knew words, but he didn't know the language, sadly.
I was thinking about another thing about the English Passengers. In an interview a few years ago, you were answering a question about the writers who inspired you, and you said, "I particularly value writers who can say something serious using humor." Mm-hmm. And this is something that we haven't talked about yet, because even though it's true that the subjects you're dealing with are extremely serious, there is a very great part of humor in your book. So could you talk a little about about this?
I think it's humor? Just, I do, I mean, I enjoy books that have a humorous aspect, and also I think that if you treat a very serious subject only in a serious way, that it actually can be less effective in that there's no relief, there's no release, whereas if you offer intermittent release, it mustn't make the whole thing funny, but intermittent release, then when something terrible happens, it's more shocking. I think it's very important to vary the tone.
Now, you must have had fun when writing about the Reverend's theory of divine refrigeration. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about that, particularly for those who haven't yet read the book but who are going to read it tomorrow. where you found this amazing idea, whether it comes from a fact or what inspired you to invent the theory of divine refrigeration?
I actually begin to forget how much I did invent, but I wanted to look at strange religious theories of the 1850s, and I found that in the Bodleian Library there was a whole series of religious pamphlets from that time, but they were deep in the stacks, deep underground. So, but I was able to get permission to go down. This is huge corridors, they're slightly misty. It's a very strange place. So I spent 3 days sitting here going through all these religious pamphlets, and I found one by a geological vicar who really wanted to prove the literal truth of the Bible. And he had the great problem that at this time all sorts of geological discoveries were being made which indicated that rocks were very, very ancient and much more ancient than the Bible indicated, which seemed to indicate that it was about 6,000 years old. So I can't remember whether I invented the theory of divine refrigeration or whether it was already there. But either way, if I invented it, he could well have invented it.
Right. In the misty corridor.
And this offered the useful explanation that the Earth had been in a molten state but had been cooled very, very quickly, as with the effect of an enormous fridge, except they didn't have fridges in those days, but they had the concept of refrigeration very quickly, so that the rocks would cool in a few days and then everything would be in order.
Yes, I was particularly interested in the way you make Wilson human in the end, because he's not only a comic, ludicrous figure, but he finally gets to doubt, and he is confronted with the horror of the void of a godless world, and that passage I find very effective, very moving. And then in the end, of course, he happily loses his wits. But I found that reminded me of Graham Swift's novel Ever After, with that same the Darwinian fracture of the world losing its meaning, and especially Wilson with his pompous ego suddenly seeing himself as self-invention and just wind. Mm. And that was one of the ways, I didn't have time to develop it, but what I meant by characterization, rounded characterization, in the except for Potter, the abominable Dr. Potter, they all have a human side.
Any influence from films, thinking of your father and thinking of François Truffaut, L'Enfant Sauvage, seen the film? Mm. Yes, did it help you at all, or did you think about it with the education of Pivet? And,
I'm sure I did, actually, because it's such a memorable film. Right. Yes.
What about what Anthony Burgess wrote about the way he put words, invented a sort of primitive language the cavemen as well? You probably saw the film, La Guerre du Feu, the War of the Fire.
I haven't seen that one. No, I was interested in Anthony Burgess's use of language in The Clockwork Orange.
In The Clockwork Orange, yes.
Which I thought was very interesting.
Certainly.